You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Citizen Chambers by Dan Adler. Chambers didn't like the city anymore. Same effing played out story as everybody else. It ain't what it used to be. And usually came to town only because of Schnabel, though he didn't mind having her mother watch their 2.5-year-old son. On this occasion, he was eager to be here. Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, and Chambers planned to see him speak at an anti-imperialist summit at Cooper Union. A few of Chambers's comrades, as he referred to them, had also told him about a reception later. Schnabel, like her grandparents and her stepmother and all her siblings and half-siblings, had a small part in her father's 2000 movie Before Night Falls, an adaptation of the Fidel Castro critic Reinaldo Arenas' memoir, which made Chambers all the more excited to bring her to meet the delegation. We passed through a small area of the neighborhood, sometimes known as Ukrainian Village, and Chambers muttered to himself after seeing a sign objecting to Russia's invasion. Between slices at a nearby pizzeria, he slapped a sticker saying, "Let Cuba live," onto the collection on the wall. As Chambers ate, he continued tracing through his line of thinking on this and related issues, stopping only to get cash from an ATM after we left to go to a bar. "Cuba," he said, "is struggling in some of the same ways the U.S.-induced Venezuela and Iraq struggle. It's immaterial to distinguish between any member of NATO and affiliated countries, all vassals of the United States in some way. With so many people having nothing to lose, some of the conditions for revolution are in place to advance the interests of the global working class. But it would require an organized and centralized party formation, a cadre of professionals, to develop the strategy. He could fund some of the necessary political education. He didn't want to fall into the trope of a rich kid searching for his voice, and he had to let go of notions of personal redemption. But he did come to realize that the only way that I can sort of save my soul was through a focus on collective struggle. Look, there's probably a lot of effing rich people that do nothing redeeming whatsoever, but they're very happy," Chambers said, drinking a rum and coke he thought was too weak, but this contradicted his experience. "I've been around some of my family and people in their circle, and some people in Stella's circle. A lot of these people are not very happy." After some long gaps in their relationship, Chambers and Schnabel had recently started to coalesce nicely, he said. She was on her way to meet us after seeing the Stephen Sondheim musical Merrily We Roll Along with her St. Anne's classmate Zach Posen, the fashion designer who once described her as his muse. "He dressed up as the Pope for graduation," Chambers said. "He's a very nice guy, not a politically serious person. He seemed to have come to terms with his girlfriend's world, stressing again that it wasn't really one that he had known prior. She was the first rich person I've ever been close to. Even Stella's brothers are chill," Chambers said. "Whatever." Still, as he saw it, Schnabel long had some inkling that there was something very effed up about the ideology of the place she came from, even if she wouldn't have known how to articulate that, but she would put it better than I would. "When I was living here," Schnabel said after she arrived, "I was constantly trying to get out." She was wearing fuchsia snakeskin print pants and a beige coat, and Chambers gleefully relayed what had happened earlier, I almost got into a physical fight with a cop on the street, he told her. We were up in each other's face. A couple of days later, passing through the neighborhood again, Chambers posted a selfie wearing a Stalin t-shirt on X, writing, "Greetings, Manhattan's Ukrainian village. I heard there might be some crop hoarding going on." There were new swaths of observers to note that an heir to the Cox fortune was cheekily commemorating the man-made famine that killed millions in Soviet Ukraine in the 1930s. Chambers had already told me in person that gestures like his police run-in weren't ultimately principled or important, and that he had outgrown thinking of such a skirmish as an accomplishment. He didn't betray much anxiety about this at the time, but he texted the next day to say, "Still embarrassed about the cop, LOL." Growing up, Chambers thought of his father as a radical. He learned early on to hate the police, and they bonded around politics and sports. "I really loved my dad," he said, and in his 20s, as he dealt with his first divorce or had a bad trip, he called him for help. But he came to resent how Jim's politics never crossed the line of class struggle as his had, and how he softened on his principles while getting tired and old. Jim's new wife, Nabila Khashoggi, was another child of immense wealth and a former actor who once professed her devotion to Scientology to a British tabloid. In 2013, as part of the family's new estate planning strategy, Anne transferred almost all of her 49% share in Cox Enterprises in equal parts to her three children. Jim became a billionaire, and he's the one getting phone calls from Rahm Emanuel, Chambers said. He's the one that has access to the NBA ownership group. Chambers doubted that his father would speak to him again, and he didn't especially want Jim to have a relationship with his kids. "I don't know what it was that made me feel confident enough to not really F with really anyone in my family anymore," he said. He wasn't as certain of his mother's attitude toward having a relationship with him, but guessed she would like to maintain one. He wasn't interested. In the fall of 2021, he said, while he and Schnabel were in a protracted fight, and when a friend had recently died, his mother called her on the day of the funeral and told her he was bipolar and needed medication. He wrote to his mother. "I sent her the most scathing note," Chambers said. "It said something like, 'I'll see you at my grandmother's funeral, not before or after.'" Hamilton didn't return request for comment. Reached by text, Schnabel first said Hamilton never called that day or told her that. A few minutes later, she said Hamilton had called her a few days after the funeral. Then she said, "I have no comment about his mother." Chambers and Schnabel reunited a few weeks later when he went to the Hamptons for an awful Thanksgiving with her family. "They would probably both hate to hear this," Chambers said, "but I think my father has plenty in common with someone like Julian." Chambers stayed with Schnabel for a few weeks, with her mother and the baby, and they started to work it out. They went to meet her sister in Sicily for Christmas and extended their trip while Chambers tried to figure out what the makeup of the European communist movement looked like just for fun. He was continuing to finance the Massachusetts land project with stipended workers now living on it, but he thought about moving to Long Island to be closer to Schnabel when she wanted to be near her mother. In recent months, Schnabel has become increasingly vocal on Instagram. Her bio reads anti-racist, anti-fascist, and both she and Chambers have turned their ire toward the classes of New York wealth in which they grew up. There are rumors and jokes among her friends about some sort of cult taking place on the land project, though the reality may be closer to a state of perpetual disorganization. One woman in downtown circles went to work there, but it seemed to end poorly. Schnabel bemoaned evil hoarding bitches on Instagram and wrote that the woman was that stupid you don't know when you miss out on a great opportunity. Schnabel later described her to me as a great friend and a great part of the collective who didn't want to stay in the country. Are they still together? A friend of Schnabel's asked me. He's a pathological narcissist. But everyone knows that, the friend went on. Their deeper breakthrough took more observation. I'm a communist. I don't want it, they imagined Chambers boasting. It's his way of letting you know he's got lots of money. To get to Ukraine in 2022, Chambers had to go to Russia first. He called and emailed embassies throughout Europe, with flights already canceled and sanctions underway. He rented a car in Sicily and drove to Tuscany, and then Florence, and then to Moldova and Romania, where he tried to get a visa. After living in St. Petersburg and purchasing an apartment where his first wife's uncle now lives, he had some advantages. His mission was to write the story of the Russian invasion from his perspective. Given his resources and the prevailing Western sentiment, it felt to him like an obligation. A representative for the Luhansk People's Republic's Federation of Trade Unions helped him get press accreditation for the separatist regions, and the consulate in Moldova eventually supplied a visa. He headed to St. Petersburg, Moscow, and then Rostov, close enough to the war that he took a taxi to the Donbas border. Chambers said he saw shelled neighborhoods and a recently bombed market, where he came across the body of an elderly woman on the ground in pieces. The only thing anyone's angry at Putin about there, he claimed, is that he didn't intervene sooner. He believes that the U.S. sending weapons is the largest impediment to peace in the area, and, like his former gym employee Green, that the Ukrainian government and military contain significant Nazi elements. Chambers' citizen journalism stint comprised a series of Substack dispatches and a few pieces for left-wing outlets. I got the story I wanted to get, he said. I understood what I needed to understand, and it was time to go home. Chambers said he had already told Cox that he would consider being bought out of the company. When the call came, he had been bashing his family members by name for about a month. The negotiations took nearly a year. Under the terms of agreement, he said he couldn't get into all the specifics, but he noted that the $250 million was only a portion of what he'll receive in the next 15 years. The windfall presented a certain predicament. Well, why didn't you cut yourself off, Chambers said, mocking the most obvious criticism he's faced. He saw it as a matter of strategy. By holding on to money, his thinking went, you can easily make more money, all the while gathering more information about how to spend it. And the money could be useful soon. Chambers thought our political crisis could develop overnight here. On the advice of a communist friend, Chambers hired a staff. You need someone to handle your emails, he was told, and like hire an MF to watch your dogs when you need to leave town. He was now mostly living in New Hampshire, but the land project continued in Massachusetts, where he had bought a marble quarry. He erected a communist library and a state-of-the-art MMA gym. The rubbernecking was getting underway. He didn't want to be put in the zoo as an absurdity, Chambers said, but he thought he had some media savvy and could generate bad press around Cop City. He gave an interview to the New York Post, which pointed out that he had secured an alleged payout more befitting an oligarch than a proletariat. He continued to pop up on social media, mostly as an oddity, until Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th. Great Barrington is one of the posher weekend destinations in western Massachusetts, a town of roughly 7,000 that Vogue has described as quietly cool and home of the Bard-affiliated liberal arts college Simon's Rock. Chambers' land in Alford was a few minutes away. The Berkshire Communist marched down Main Street on October 10th, chanting from the river to the sea. Chambers told the Berkshire Edge that the Al-Aqsa flood was a powerful statement of resistance to genocide. The paper pulled real estate records showing the properties belonging to an LLC he owns. About 50 acres for over $5 million spread among six purchases. We need to start making people who support Israel actually afraid to go out in public, Chambers wrote on Instagram. In November, the Berkshire Eagle published a profile, young, communist, gun owner, multimillionaire, describing his social media utterances as a threat to anyone who supports Israel, and noting that, with Great Barrington residents starting to become frightened, the district attorney's office and police detective unit were on alert. Chambers explained to the Eagle that he didn't personally keep any firearms in Alford, only shotguns on a mountain in New Hampshire, like everybody else, and had no plans to raise a militia or harm anyone. He wrote online that there weren't any guns on his Massachusetts land beyond a shotgun or two with lawfully permitted owners. The Free Beacon described Chambers as using daddy's money to harass Jews, noting that he had been paying legal fees for members of the U.S. branch of Palestine Action, a loose social media-based protest network that has sought to disrupt the work of Israeli weapons suppliers. The Free Press, the online media company founded by Barry Weiss, sent a reporter, her sister, Susie, to New Hampshire to profile Chambers. There are very liberal colleges with very liberal students who want to take the theories they learn in the classroom into the streets, the writer surmised. And then there's Fergie, with hundreds of millions of dollars, eager to make it all go boom. The notion bore little resemblance to the colleges of the Berkshires, but it did faithfully convey the literal content of Chambers' social media output. In October, he and other protesters locked themselves to the door of Israeli defense company Elbit Systems' office in Cambridge. He sent me a voice message explaining how he evaded arrest by hiding in his grandmother's backyard. On a Monday morning the next month, Palestine Action protesters blocked the entrance to Elbit's New Hampshire campus. Some of them went to the roof of the building, where they poured red paint down the facade and set off flares. They smashed windows and locked a lobby door with a bicycle anti-theft device. No one was hurt, and the most immediate reverberation from the day was the arrest of three women between the ages of 19 and 27. They were charged with riot, conspiracy to commit criminal mischief, burglary, and conspiracy to commit falsifying physical evidence, felony charges that are each punishable by 3.5 to 7 years in state prison. New Hampshire's Republican Attorney General John Formella announced that he was investigating potential Civil Rights Act violations. Chambers paid $50,000 to bail the women out. A building inspector told the Alford Select Board in December that the facility housing the Berkshire People's Gym was not permitted for commercial use, only agricultural storage and farm equipment, and began sending cease and desist notices. On New Year's Day, the barn was cleared out. The gym is gone, the board chair said at the next meeting. Toward the end of the year, I thought I might not speak with Chambers again. There was a rumor among friends of Schnabel's that the FBI was looking for him, and over text, he seemed tentative about the increasingly suggestive press and social media attention he was receiving. He switched to using an encrypted messaging app. Then, one Sunday afternoon, he video called me. He was in Tunisia, though he asked to keep that quiet, wearing a brown kufi and rolling a cigarette in a sleek but not opulent apartment. Between bites of a sandwich, he explained his intentions in his new locale, where Schnabel would arrive the next day. In the first place, they would take Shahada. I realized that I was definitely being too cavalier in some ways, Chambers said, definitely too self-obsessed. He thought that in the last couple of years he had been productive on a political level, but generally scattered, relying too much on weed and training as his personal turmoil mounted. I'm looking over my shoulder everywhere, he said. He was panicking as he left the U.S., but calmed down when he sat on the phone reading the Quran. He began studying Arabic and going to the mosque 5 times a day. That's another thing I know people will want to caricature, Chambers said. I don't really care. In the aftermath of the New Hampshire arrest, he said he generally wanted to keep a lower profile. It feels like my existence is part of why these women are facing years in prison, Chambers said, and I hate that. Tunisia has no extradition treaty with the U.S., and Chambers seemed to play with the idea. Federal agents showed up at Schnabel's home in Long Island, he said, and police called a friend of his in Vermont. No agents showed up at my house in L1 at all, ever at any time, Schnabel said, but later texted to say that someone did arrive, possibly PSEG or a plumber. There are people that are facing a lot of really severe stuff right now, he continued, including maybe me, we don't know. A few tweets noting the age and gender dynamics of the Berkshire communist had surfaced following the arrest. People want to make this connection, and they want to effing skewer me, he said. They probably think I'm like a crazy Charles Manson terrorist. By January, Chambers was open about his whereabouts. His profile on X listed his location as Tunis, and this was written in Arabic. He and Schnabel married the following month. In March, Chambers was upset about how he had been depicted in a cluster of interviews. Not enough was made, he said, of his distance from drinking and drugs, or the need to connect movements to the global South. People from his past have often seemed conflicted about how interesting or important he is, or how dangerous. The general consensus among St. Anne's classmates was that while they did not specifically expect anything violent to happen with Chambers, they would not be shocked if it did. Chambers said that at times he has contemplated simply disappearing. He ultimately ruled it out. Is that what's going to happen to me? He asked himself. They're going to shut me up. I can't have that, he said in Tunisia, leaning back in his chair. When he was a kid, he became accustomed to seeing his father intermittently. He was starting to worry about the same pattern developing with his 3 older children in Atlanta, and he could see how his relationship to his family had informed his oppositional stance. Of course, if my father is shitty in a number of ways, then my daddy issues influenced what I do politically, he said. I guess I just expected they were going to steadily become more pleased with me. People in his position often liked attention, he understood, and perhaps even more than attention, disillusionment. It was unavoidable. This is what I came from, Chambers said. There's nothing we can do about that. Salon Culture, a Met exhibition on the impact of the Harlem Renaissance illuminates a link between beauty pioneer Madame C.J. Walker and contemporary art, by Andriana Campbell Lafleur. Opening painting by Jessica Spence, which shows a young woman having her hair braided. In the photo, Madame C.J. Walker's beauty salon, photographed by James Vanderzee in 1929. A 1911 photograph shows Madame C.J. Walker in the driver's seat of an automobile, portering a car full of women. A veritable metaphor for collective success. At the time, Walker had recently incorporated her hair care enterprise, which ultimately made her one of the nation's first black millionaires. As the Louisiana native later told Booker T. Washington, "I promoted myself into the business of manufacturing goods and preparations. I have built my own factory on my own ground." Walker trained hair culturist at the Lelia College of Beauty Culture, named after her daughter, Alelia, and brought the talented tenth of intelligentsia and wealth into her orbit. Renowned for their fantastic glamour, the two Walkers lived not far from the Rockefellers at their estate, Villa Loaro, in Irvington-on-Hudson, New York. After CJ's death in 1919, her two Harlem townhouses continued to thrive under Alelia as places for conversation about art, culture, and politics. Based on the Baroque-era gatherings of Madame de Pompadour of the famous steepled hair, the word salon carried a double meaning in Walker's beauty parlors, as seen in a 1929 photograph by James Vanderzee. The clientele, in kitten heels, bob cuts, and finger waves, coolly converse over tea. This view of cosmopolitan life is one of many in the Harlem Renaissance and transatlantic modernism, which opened in February at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Curated by Denise Murrell, the exhibition convenes the era's thinkers and visionaries. Marian Anderson, resplendent in red, painted by Laura Wheeler Waring, Zora Neale Hurston in a pastel by Aaron Douglas, Paul Robeson, immortalized in bronze, and Josephine Baker on film. Vanderzee's roving lens is particularly attuned to the significance of African diasporic communities. A transgender person in a fur-trimmed ensemble evokes avenues for acceptance in the era, and the subdued scene at Walker's is just as central to the glitz. Beauty shops are a mainstay of neighborhood garrulity, sites for transformation, where the fresh coif brings its own twist of renaissance. Carrie James Marshall's 2012 painting, School of Beauty, School of Culture, shows a salon at its most boisterous, where children play on the wood floor, and posters of Lauryn Hill and Chris Sofili share space with advertisements for dark and lovely hair color. Hair is also a recurring topos in Jessica Spence's graphic, vivid paintings. 6 Hours, from 2017, shown here, alludes to a kind of durational performance that takes place in a braid shop in Westchester County, New York. Just a short drive from Walker's Renaissance Revival manse, where the likes of Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois gathered. Spence, who notes Marshall as an influence, attended a 2019 salon, Encyclopédie, in Brooklyn, where a new generation discussed the overlapping worlds of media, art, and culture. In a sense, it was a milieu that Walker herself would soon rejoin, with the 2020 Netflix miniseries Self-Made, starring Octavia Spencer. The entrepreneur finally got the gleaming Hollywood treatment, and the stylist in Spence's painting, wearing her crystal-studded apron, does too. Thank you. Forever Simone, the greatest gymnast of all time, opens up about life as a newlywed, her recovery from Tokyo, and what's ahead, including Paris. By Leah Fay Cooper, with high fashion photos by Adrian Raquel, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. "Maybe he has a crush on you," Simone Biles says to me, playfully, but also seriously. It's a Thursday evening in the Woodlands, a Tony Houston suburb, and the greatest gymnast of all time and I are having dinner at 60 Vines, known for its seasonal cuisine and 60 wines on tap. Biles picked the restaurant. It's one of her favorites, and she comes often. But as a succession of dishes arrives, compliments of the kitchen, seared bass, sliced tri-tip, and later sticky toffee cake and Basque cheesecake, delivered by Chef Mikhail Saeed himself, she notes, "This has never happened before." According to Biles, he must be trying to impress me, an unrecognizable writer, and not her, a two-time Olympian and holder of 37 Olympic and World Championship medals, the most in history. "I have a feeling it's not about me," I say, clocking at least three people stealing stares at, definitely her, but we'll go with that. Wearing her sense of humor like a leotard is presumably one of the ways Biles has weathered a life and career marked by record-breaking highs and excruciating lows. After a two-year hiatus following the Tokyo Olympics, Biles returned to competition last August at the U.S. Gymnastics Championships in San Jose, California. There, the 26-year-old won an eighth national title, becoming the oldest woman to clinch the victory and breaking the late Alfred Joachim's seven-title record, which had been in place since 1933. Last fall, at the 2023 Artistic Gymnastics World Championships in Antwerp, Belgium, Biles became the most decorated gymnast in history, winning gold in the individual all-around, her sixth title, and the most ever for a woman, gold in the balance beam and floor, and silver in the vault. At 26, she also became the oldest U.S. woman athlete ever to win those medals. "I felt like I was back in my element, and it was exciting," she says, "but I was truly petrified. I had the training to back it up because we worked really hard. But I wasn't as confident or as comfortable as I wanted to be." Whatever impact the nerves had on Biles, they didn't deter her from landing a Yurchenko double pike vault, a first for a woman in international competition. The move, which consists of a round-off onto a springboard, a back handspring onto a vault, and two flips in the pike position, has since been renamed the Biles II, bringing the total of stunts coined after the 4'8" phenom to 5. "It was kind of surprising," Biles says of her success back on the circuit, her modesty genuine. "Just taking the risk of allowing myself to be vulnerable in front of a crowd competing again was a win for me." Antwerp also offered a refreshing mix of nostalgia and normalcy. Biles competed in her first world championships there 10 years ago, but didn't get to explore the city like she did this time around. She went to a cafe for an authentic Belgian waffle, which was amazing, she says, and explored the architecture and shops in Antwerp's Old Town neighborhood. Like so many of the places Biles' career has taken her, Antwerp is literally and figuratively worlds away from where she came from. Born in Columbus, Ohio, to a mother who struggled to care for her children as she battled addiction, Biles spent her early years in and out of foster care. At 5, Biles and her younger sister, Adria, were formally adopted by their maternal grandfather, Ron, and his wife, Nellie, whom she calls her parents, who raised the girls alongside their two boys in Spring, Texas, the Houston suburb Biles still calls home. Her two older siblings, Ashley and Tevin, were adopted by Ron's sister, Harriet. When Biles was 6, Ron and Nellie enrolled her and Adria in gymnastics classes. "Honestly, for gymnastics, that's kind of late," Biles says. "Most people start in Mommy and Me classes as soon as they can walk. I truly was gifted, but I had to work for everything that I've had because of that delay." Her parents had to work toward her success, too. "Gymnastics is very expensive, and we're so blessed that our parents could afford for us to do it," she says, adding that it's the only sport she and her sister ever pursued. Biles says she never worried about finances, but she's still not sure if that's because her parents didn't have that concern or merely shielded her from any hardship. She is, however, keenly aware of the sacrifices her entire family has made on her behalf, their time, their effort, and their money. "I just wanted to try to do college gymnastics," Biles says. But everything changed after she watched Gabby Douglas, Michaela Maroney, Ali Reisman, Kyla Ross, and Jordan Weber dominate at the 2012 Olympics in London. "I saw those girls and I was like, I'm going to the same camps they're going to. Maybe I could do that." In 2013, when Biles was 16, she won her first all-around world championship title, becoming the first African-American gymnast to do so. 3 years later, she stunned the world with her performance during the Summer Olympics in Rio, where she won 4 gold medals, an American record for women's gymnastics at a single games, plus a bronze. The rise to fame that accompanied her feat was exciting, intense, and a bit disorienting. "It still is all of those things," Biles says. "I think everyone wants to be famous, and then when it happens, you almost hit a wall, and you have an identity crisis. You're like, am I made out for this? Why did I wish for this? While the adjustment was challenging for Biles, it was especially difficult for her parents. They always wanted to protect their daughter from invasive fans, reporters, and photographers, but everything is kind of out of their hands, she says. I'm not saying that people scream and line up like I'm Taylor Swift, but I still get a lot of attention. When five people come up to me and they're rushing for a photo, I just get a little flustered. My anxiety kicks in. Nothing, then, could have prepared Biles for the aftermath of Tokyo in 2021. The games kicked off that July under unprecedented circumstances and after a year-long postponement. Athletes were largely relegated to their rooms and competition venues, and there were no spectators. Biles helped her team qualify for the all-around final and was the only athlete to qualify for the finals in all four individual events. But something was amiss. On a vault, she completed just 1.5 of an attempted 2.5 twist and nearly fell when she landed. Afterward, she withdrew from the team competition, citing mental health concerns and a word that would become household famous, the twisties, a disconnect between the mind and the body that causes a gymnast to lose track of motion through space. Though the average person watching from home probably chalked it up to nerves, I knew right then and there something was wrong, says Biles' best friend, Rachel Rutger, from her home in Spring. The two met as 6-year-olds in gymnastics class. The look Rutger noticed on her friend's faces wasn't nervousness, it was worry. I texted her, "Hey, what is going on? Are you okay?" I thought she was hurt, because there's no way she should have landed like that. She texted me like, "I'm not hurt, but I'm just going through some things." One by one, Biles began withdrawing from other competitions, the individual all-around, the vault, the uneven bars, the floor. She competed in the balance beam, winning the bronze medal. Team USA, which included Jordan Chiles, Sunisa Lee, and Grace McCallum, finished second, behind Russia. The criticism was scathing and relentless. And though many came to Biles' defense, "Of course you have all the assholes that are like you're a quitter," she says, and they just ran with that. Biles was tempted to go off on those deriding her, but ultimately decided that the only worthy fight was the one for her own well-being. Predictably, as pundits and trolls declared that the Olympian had selfishly let her country down, others tried to put me on this pedestal as a mental health advocate, she says. I was not okay with that. If I can be a lending hand and help people, then I'll be open, honest, and vulnerable, she continues. But you cannot stick me in front of a crowd and say, do everything she's doing. Biles had a major source of support in her then-boyfriend, Jonathan Owens, an NFL safety who at the time was playing for the Houston Texans. The pair had met in 2020 on an invite-only dating app. "I had just broken up with someone, and my friend was like, 'Get on Rhea, get on Rhea,'" Biles tells me as our spread continues expanding into burrata, Caesar salad, and Brussels sprouts. "My guard went straight up when she said dating site," Biles says, "but she matched with Owens the first week she was on the app. The second week I met him in person," she says, "and the rest is history. We were hooked." Owens' recollection is similar, with one added detail. "She doesn't like to admit it, but she messaged me first," he tells me over the phone. Because their relationship started at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, most of their early dates consisted of watching movies, playing games, and drinking sangria at each other's houses during quarantine. "I just noticed her laugh," Owens says of those initial interactions. "It was just contagious. We could talk all day, and we'd stayed up late, and there just wasn't an awkward moment." Owens knew immediately that he liked Biles. But I ask, did he know he was falling for the greatest gymnast of all time? "A lot of people don't believe me when I say I had no clue," he insists. During the 2016 Olympics in Rio, Owens was at training camp at his alma mater, Missouri Western State University. He caught some basketball and a bit of track, but I never once was like, oh, let me check gymnastics out. Things clicked when he found Biles on Instagram. I was like, man, she got a lot of followers. She must be pretty good. We got close really quickly, Raisman says, of her time training with Biles before the 2016 games. We have very different personalities. When I was training, I was a lot more of a perfectionist, she continues, speaking on a call from her home in Boston. Simone is definitely more laid back than I am. That balance was really good for me. She was always making me laugh. Biles was always raising the competitive bar for the team, too. We always used to joke, second place was first place because it was too hard to beat her, Raisman says. Their bond strengthened under devastating circumstances. Both are among more than 200 women who came forward with sexual abuse allegations against former USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. He was ultimately convicted of various crimes and will spend the rest of his life in prison. I'm very grateful for the support and how much our voices were heard, Raisman says. But it felt like an open wound that wouldn't heal. So to have Simone, who understood what I was going through, we could talk about it, and we could relate when I felt like I couldn't relate to most people, it was really nice. It still is very nice to have that. Coming forward with their experiences not only shocked the world, but it shocked those closest to the gymnast, too. It was really heartbreaking to hear her side of the story and hear what happened, Rutger says. I had no idea. I had no idea at all. Biles doesn't address the abuse directly, but in discussing why she's been so outspoken against USA Gymnastics and the organization's failure to protect athletes in the past, she asserts that she's been through hell and back. She could have dealt with that trauma privately, she says, but knowing that people listen when she speaks, a realization that she says took her a while to come to, helps her. I wish everybody could have the outlets and the platforms and the confidence to speak out, she says, but she knows that's not the case. Sometimes I'm speaking not only for myself, but I'm being a voice for others that can't. Biles believes that USA Gymnastics has been moving in a positive direction. When something like that happens, it obviously turns everything completely upside down, she says. And then they make some of the rules so strict that it almost makes it hard for anybody to do their job, but I think their intentions are there. Last year, Raisman tuned in with pride to watch her friend and former teammate compete in Antwerp. For her to come back now, she says of Biles' post-Tokyo return, it really feels like she's doing it for herself, and she's doing it on her own terms. Over the course of our call, Raisman repeatedly points out that Biles makes everything look so easy. It's an accurate observation of her stunts and of her foray back into gymnastics, but neither are easy. I wish I could sit here and tell you it was glorious, Biles says, of her time off following Tokyo. When I took a break after 2016, I had the time of my life. I was doing anything and everything. But after 2020, it was kind of depressing until I started therapy and got help. I felt like a failure. Even though I was empowering so many people and speaking out about mental health, every time I talked about my experience in Tokyo, because it obviously didn't go the way that I had planned, it stung a little bit. But all in all, it was the best decision. Biles remains a vocal proponent of mental health care. I've always been in therapy, and I've always been an advocate for medicine, she says, adding that her mother, Nellie, is a nurse, and medication has never been stigmatized in her family. If you need an inhaler, take it. If you have anxiety, take it. I'm no stranger to medicine. Years ago, Biles was prescribed Lexapro for anxiety, and she continues to take the medication today. When Biles resumed training in late 2022, the gymnastics was largely mental. She tried convincing herself that she was cured from the twisties, that she wasn't scared to jump and flip and catapult herself into the air. Well, that was a lie, she says. I was petrified. Biles eased her way back into a training routine, spending a few gym sessions just jumping on the trampoline, gradually working her way toward one full workout a day. By January 2023, she was back to the training schedule she currently maintains 4 days a week, up at 6:20 a.m. and out the door by 6:45 for 7 a.m. practice. Home at 10:30, then lunch. She tends to her three bulldogs, Lilo, Rambo, and Zeus, then naps for an hour to an hour and a half, then back at the gym from 2 to 5 p.m. Thursdays and Saturdays are half days. Sunday is off. Biles is enjoying the regimen more than she anticipated. I owe that to my teammates, she says, adding that most of them are much younger. I didn't think I'd be having fun like this at my age in the gym, but they keep it fun. They've been bigger rocks to me than they know. One of those teammates is UCLA standout Chiles, who trains in Texas during the collegiate off-season. Seeing her do all of her skills that are named after her, Chiles says, I'm just in awe. The two met about a decade ago at a national team camp. Giddy over the opportunity to interact with Biles, the current NCAA floor exercise and uneven bars champion remembers thinking to herself, this girl's going to be my friend one day. That premonition proved true. Biles helped the Oregon native make arrangements to train in Texas prior to Tokyo, and when Biles and Owens wed in Cabo last May, Chiles was among their 144 guests. When Biles got back in the gym, she was sure that she wanted to go after a spot on the 2024 Olympic team. Her training and competition schedule suggest that's still the case. During an October 2023 episode of Today, when Hoda Kotb asked if wagering $100 on Biles' return was a safe bet, the gymnast told her, I think you'd be pretty lucky. She's much more coy about the decision over dinner, though. As Biles and I move on from the Brussels sprouts to the desserts, she tells me that she's taking her friends out the following night. I'm doing a little party bus, she says, sharing that they'll be heading to Ciel, a restaurant and lounge in central Houston, featuring Vegas-like entertainment. I'm so excited, she says, and understandably so. For every skill Biles mastered and medal she won, there was a birthday party she didn't go to or a school dance she skipped. I used to be really sad about it, she says, of all the moments she missed out on, but they come back to you. For the past 2 hours, Biles' confidence has radiated across the dinner table. That self-assuredness took a while to grow into, she says. It's palpable, but so is the faith and humility that keeps her grounded. I never thought I'd be who I am, she says, but look at God's blessings. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.